Good morning. So last time we talked about a bunch of assembly related topics, finishing up talking about how we'd write a recursive function, which hopefully has been helpful as you've worked on the pre-lab, or will be helpful for those of you who haven't started the pre-lab for some reason. And we have this basic idea that we have a stack, which we call the stack, controlled by an x86, the RSP register, which points to the most recently pushed item on the stack. And we use that to track both our calls for knowing where to return from and temporary values. In this case, we want to save a copy of our old argument while we're doing our recursive call, then get it back. So before I move on to talk about a bunch of miscellaneous assembly topics, we kind of skipped ahead because of the snow day. Any questions about this example or other things we covered last time? Okay. So when we just finished up last time, we were talking about ways of specifying pointers. So I mentioned that we saw these move instructions where we specified a memory location, and we have this particular form that we're allowed to use. So we can specify a value here, a 64-bit base register, and a index register, which we can multiply by as 1, 2, 4, and 8. So that choice isn't arbitrary. The idea is that this is most frequently going to be helpful for implementing array accesses, where you have arrays of ints, shorts, carers, and so on. So they made hardware support for doing that. And it turns out that also multiplying 1, 2, 4, 8 in hardware is really easy. You just add a bunch of zeros. Whereas if they like supporting multiplying by 12, that would be really hard to do fast. And adding a 32-bit sign constants. And often you'll see a label there, because labels, remember, are constants, which just represent a memory location. So this means that all of these are valid moves. We can move a register, in this case, RBX into RAX. We can move RBX used as a pointer to access memory location and move that value from memory into RAX. We can move from RBX to a memory location specified by a label. We're just specifying the 32-bit constant in that case. We can specify a register minus a value. In this case, we're specifying a register plus a negative 32-bit constant. We can add two registers together. In this case, we're specifying a base register and an index register times 1. And we can move a base register times an index register plus an index register times, in this case, 4, one of those primitive constants, and we're adding 0 effectively to get our memory address, accessing memory there, storing that value in RBX. So these are all valid moves. And basically every variant of anything I could emit, and we sometimes have this shorthand, like where we don't need to specify times 1, our assembler figures that out for us. We don't need to specify plus 0, our assembler figures that out. We can write labels instead of writing numbers. But it's all shorthand for those three fields, each of which is optional. There are things we can't do, which you might have thought, if I just showed you those examples of valid moves, you might say, why aren't these valid? And it's because they don't fit that pattern I showed you earlier, so you can't do, say, one register minus another, because we can only subtract constants effectively by adding a negative number. You can't add three registers together. We only have slots for 2. And we can only multiply one register times a constant. So that's sort of the rest of specifying memory locations. So I've showed you all these examples with moves. This is going to happen any time we need to specify a memory location. We're allowed to use these options. So when we have, for example, an add instruction, we can add to a memory location. We can use all these options to do that. And not these, all these options and not these options. So other thing with memory accesses are the lengths we're accessing. So if you want to move 1 byte, it's pretty obvious when you specify a register like BL. If you remember our picture of all the registers, BL was the lower 8-bit part of the RBX register. So that's 8 bits, so it has to be 1 byte. So it's obvious when you move into BL that you're doing a 1-byte move. But you can specify explicitly by adding this byte pointer syntax that when you have a value for memory, that it's a byte. For registers, we don't do this because, well, BL has to be a byte. But there is one case where we have to do it, and that's when we're doing something like this. Because if I don't write byte pointer there, that is not the right value. Something like, I wrote something invalid on this slide, RBX, because you can't use BL as a memory address, because it's 8 bits, sorry. But when we're doing something like this, where we're moving into a memory location, so you have to write RBX, you have to do a 64-bit value, and I just mentioned that here, so that would be another invalid memory access. But if we write RBX, which is meant, it's just thinking of, 8-bit value, therefore I write BL. No, that's a common mistake. So if you do byte pointer RBX here, if we just did move RBX 42, I don't know what the size of 42 is. Is 42 a byte? Is it a 32-bit value? Is it a 64-bit value? All those things are valid. So I need to disambiguate by writing byte pointer or something like that. So we all have other words we can use. We can write word pointer for a 2-byte value, D word for a 4-byte, Q word for an 8-byte. And these are all things you'll have to do, or you'll see compilers generating code to do in cases where we can't figure out, based on something like this, that this is 8 bits. We can't figure out the size of the move otherwise. And this mostly comes up when you have something like this, or you have equivalently a similar add. Like, you can't figure out, am I adding to a single byte value, am I adding to a 64-bit value? Can't tell from that add instruction unless I write down the size. I believe our assembler has some default size to use, but I recommend cases where it's ambiguous, just always writing it down rather than assuming the assembler knows what to do. Okay, so any questions about these specifications of sizes? Okay. So let's go over some additional miscellaneous instructions we kind of skipped over the first time. So first, a very simple one. There's increment and decrement, INC and DEC. They're the same as adding and subtracting one. They're just shorter to write. So talk about multiplication. So we have a straightforward multiply instruction where we specify two registers, or a register and a value in memory, or a register and a constant. So these are a little different than the other arithmetic instructions we've seen. So one difference is, unlike our add instruction or a subtract instruction or our increment instruction, the first operand has to be a register. You aren't allowed to use a memory location. The second one you can have be a register, or memory location, or a constant as usual. There's also this second form here, which takes three arguments that you might see the compiler use occasionally, where the third argument has to be a constant. So these are two forms to multiply, and it turns out there's yet another. So there's a version of multiply where, unlike all these versions, we get a result which is bigger. So for example, we can multiply two 64-bit values together and get a 128-bit result. And the way x86 has chosen to do this is they have chosen arbitrarily that when you get a big result like that, it goes into RDX and RAX as a pair, where RAX contains the lower 64 bits of the result, and RDX contains the upper 64 bits. And the form it takes looks like this, and the multiplication always involves RAX as one of the operands. You can't specify anything else. It's just hard-coded, it's RAX. This goes back to that history of, remember I told you, in older things that x86 came from, a lot of the registers were special. This is an example of that happening. So the 64-bit version looks like we say, like, IMUL RBX, that will do RAX times RBX, put the lower 64 bits of the result in RAX, the upper 64 bits in RDX. And that's what that would look like, and you can specify a memory location as the source. So I mentioned this not because I expect you to write this, but because if you read compiler-generated code with multiplications, it often writes this. You can also see this with 32-bit operands, in which case it does the same thing, but with 32-bit registers. So we multiply two 32-bit values, we get a 64-bit result, but rather than storing the 64-bit result in one of our 64-bit registers, we split it across two 32-bit registers. The way you can think about why this makes sense is that this instruction dates back to when we didn't have 64-bit registers. So it works the exact same way it did when we only had 32-bit registers. We didn't have an option to store it in a 64-bit register. And this also exists for 16 and 8 bits. So any questions about these multiply instructions? So one final thing about the multiply, which is a bit strange, which is signed versus unsigned. So when our result sizes are equal to our source size, it doesn't matter. It turns out that if you reason about two's complement, you get the same thing. A way you can get some intuition for this is that multiplication is repeated addition. If you add something a bunch of times in two's complement, things work out. With a bigger result, because you have to figure out how do you add the extra zeros or whatever to keep the value the same when you have a signed number, it doesn't work out that way. So there's two versions of the multiply instructions for the bigger result. One's called IMUL, which is the signed version, and one called MUL, which is the unsigned version. And these just differ in what the upper half of the result will look like. Whether it will reflect a signed multiplication, like times -1 will give you a negative result, or whether it will reflect an unsigned multiplication where times -1 is really you're multiplying by a big, very big positive number instead. And that will appear in the upper 64 bits of the result. So that's multiplication. There's also division. And our division instruction mirrors that big result multiplication instruction I just showed you. So we take as our operands the pair of RDX and RAX, and we divide by an argument that you supply, which can be something like, say, RBX. So we take that 128-bit value, divide it by a 64-bit value you supply, and we put the result of the division in RAX, and at the same time, the processor always computes the modulus, and it puts the result of the modulus in RDX. So this is also the instruction used to implement mod. And you can do this also with a 32-bit operand, and it works the same way, just with 64-bit values divided by 32-bit values with 32-bit results. And like with multiplication, IDIV is the signed version, DIV is the unsigned version. Division actually ends up being different. Any questions about how this works? OK. So one final instruction we're going to talk about, because more so than the multiplication and division instructions I showed you, this will appear all over the place in what compilers generate. And this is an instruction called LEA, which stands for load effective address. So an effective address is the memory location computed by an instruction. So that's what effective address is a name for. So when we have a move with a memory operand, the effective address is that address that we computed to do the move. So the load effective address instruction, it has some memory location it tries to compute, and rather than doing anything with that memory location, like accessing memory and updating the value, or reading the value, or doing some computation on that value for memory, it just takes that address and throws it in a register. So we compute this effective address, and in normal instructions, we then use that to access memory. With LEA, we're done. So it looks like a move for memory, but really what we're doing is computing that address and storing it in a register. So for example, if I load the memory address RAX plus 4 into RAX, that's the same as adding 4 to RAX. You can think of this as kind of like the ampersand operator in C, like it's taking the address of RAX plus the memory at RAX plus 4, you know, kind of like doing at array of 1 would take the address of an array element rather than actually accessing the array. So it's the same sort of idea that helps you think about it. And you're going to see this all over the place in compiler-generated assembly. And there's various reasons. So one reason is if you're implementing like actual compute a value of a pointer, this is the most obvious way of doing that, right? You know, like you want to get the address of a variable you're storing, say, on the stack, you LEA something, comma, RSP plus something in brackets. But there are less obvious reasons where the compilers will generate this not to compute addresses, but just to do normal computations. So this example I have on this slide doesn't make sense. Like you would write add RAX 4 because that's just simple. But there are cases where LEA is the simplest way in x86 to do some computation. So that even though this is designed for computing addresses, our compiler doesn't care what it's designed for, it just cares what computation it does. And it says, oh, this is the simplest way of doing that, that's what I'm gonna do. So for example, you want to multiply something times 5? Well, you can do that with LEA, with one instruction, which is way easier than doing it with anything else in x86. Like you could add something to itself 5 times, you could shift it over with, there's a shift instruction we haven't talked about, and add, but everything else to do this is a whole bunch of instructions. But with LEA, you can do it with this one instruction where you load, in this case, the value plus the value times 4. Remember, we can specify a base register. Our base register here is RAX. You can specify an index register. Our index register is RAX again. The rules don't say they can't be the same thing. And we multiply the index register times 1, 2, or 4. 4 is a, or 8. 4 is a valid option. That's what we do. This ends up computing RAX times 5. And if you write, you know, some code which multiplies some value times 5, the compiler often will generate this code, generate this LEA instruction rather than something else, even though it's not an address computation, just because it does the same math. Yes?
Does it basically do the operation and then move it into RAX or specified register?
Yes, so the question is, does it do the operation, by which you mean the computation, address computation? Yeah, so it does this computation, so it does this RAX plus RAX times 4 and moves it into the destination register. Yeah. So couldn't we do something, so the question is, couldn't we have done IMAL RAX RAX 5? And the answer is yes. I believe that this instruction is both takes up more space in machine code and is slower on most x86 machines, though, the IMAP. It also has very slightly different effects on the flags, which we won't talk about much in this class, but it has slightly different semantics in some corner cases. So typically you will see compilers generate the LEA. But indeed there are other options, yes?
How would you do REX times 7 with LEA?
The question is, how would you do REX times 7 with LEA? You wouldn't. You would need some other sequence of instructions. So yes, so compilers are doing this even though it's like only little special cases which work. They have the logic when you enable optimizations to figure out, oh, I can do, in this case, I can write this as an LEA even though I can't do that in general. So, another example is that we can add two registers together with one instruction, which we can't do because our add instruction takes a destination and first source as the same register. But if we want three operands, well, LEA lets us sort of cheat and do that, and compilers will often take advantage of that too. Whereas otherwise they'd have to like move a value and then add. So any questions about LEA? LEA is, I've taught x86 assembly, by far one of the most confusing instructions for everyone. Okay. So that's our preview of some relevant instructions. We haven't gone through and will not go through a vast majority of x86 instructions because there are too many of them. So I hope I've gone through most of the ones you're likely to see when we have you do in the next week or so exercises where you have to look at compiler output, but you know, compilers sometimes will generate other instructions. Okay, so let's go back to calling functions. So last time we gave a very brief preview of how calling conventions work by telling you sort of the rules you needed to know for what we were doing for the pre-lab for calling functions. We're going to talk more generally about what calling functions look like. We'll talk about first sort of the questions we need to answer when we decide how does calling functions work. And these are generally questions which, if you look at the instructions, don't have an answer. So these questions are, where do the arguments go? Our instructions don't tell us where to put arguments. We don't have a call with arguments instruction. We just have a call instruction that jumps into a function. And some other architectures don't even have that. They have some other kind of instruction that doesn't even specify sort of where the return, how you put the return address on. You also have to ask, where do local variables go? So that's also not decided. We have some obvious places we could put them, like certain registers seem like obvious places, or the stack seems like an obvious place, but the instructions don't actually tell us what to do. We have a decision to make as either someone writing assembly code by hand or a compiler author to decide, where do I put local variables? We have to decide where the return value goes. So the return value, by which I mean the actual number or being returned, not the place we return to, and how return knows where to go. So of these, only this last one is basically decided for us, and this is because we know what the RET instruction is. So we have to put the place where return goes where the RET instruction expects it. But other than that, these are all decisions that someone needs to make who is not the processor designer, because the processor designer hasn't committed us to any particular answer to any of these questions. And if you look at real operating systems and compilers, people come up with different answers for the same processor. So for example, we're going to talk about the answers for Linux. If you look at Windows, Windows has made slightly different decisions. The decisions aren't wrong, they're just different. So we're going to talk about calling conventions. And like the name suggests, it's a convention. It's something we've agreed on. And the people who've agreed on it are generally the compiler writers and the operating system writers. They've agreed with each other. This is how function calls are going to work. So they've made that decision. And the processor hasn't done that. The processor may have made certain calling convention rules easier to implement than others. They may have encouraged it. Like, for example, we could have a calling convention where we put the place to return to in a different place than what Red expects. But that would sure make implementing function calls really annoying. Because we'd have to copy it from somewhere and then it's Red, or like turn it into a jump. Like, that would be really annoying. So, you know, in that sense, we're encouraged to do something by the processor maker. But the rules come because we, as a compiler and OS writer, need to agree on something. And the reason we need to agree on something is that we need to call each other's code. That my compiler needs to call code that both my compiler compiled at a different time and operating system code. We need to agree how that's going to work. So our processor has made some instructions to help us out in implementing particular calling conventions. And in x86, we have this call instruction, which remember pushes the return address, the place for return to go on the stack, the return instruction, which pops an address from the stack, which probably was pushed with call, but may not have been, and jumps there. And push and pop instructions to save values on this stack, which we'll commonly use when we need to put a temporary value somewhere within a function. So let's talk in detail about the answers that Linux on x86-64 has used to these questions. And these are Linux's rules about how functions should work, which they've chosen so two different people can write compilers, and those two compilers can call code from the other and have everything work out correctly. So the first question, how does return to word go? And as I said, this is kind of chosen by the processor just because we want to use the call and write instruction. You know, if we don't put it on the stack immediately where the function starts, we can't use call and write. That would be really annoying. So where do the arguments go? So here, they had to make an arbitrary decision. They could have said, we're going to put them at address 10,000 in memory. That would be an arbitrary decision. That's not the best decision. The decision they made is that they wrote down a sequence of registers, which they just chose. There's nothing special about these registers. They just chose some registers, and they chose an order for them. And they decided, these are where we're going to put arguments. So they said argument 1 goes in RDI, argument 2 goes in RSI, and so on. So they just wrote down this list of registers. Now, we don't have an infinite number of registers, so eventually we can't keep storing arguments in registers. And the people who designed the Linux calling convention decided that we're going to have 6 arguments for registers. After that, I'd like to use my registers for something else. Yes, we have, you know, 16 registers available, one of which is used for the stack pointer. So maybe we could have 15 argument registers, but we don't really care about making functions support 15 arguments, you know, all the time. So we're only going to use 6 registers. After that, we're going to switch over to using something less efficient, so we can have registers available for things besides arguments. So their decision is that argument 7 and on get pushed onto the stack. And they're going to get pushed onto the stack last argument first. So that means that on the stack, remember our stack grows this way, we're going to have the 7th argument, then the 8th argument, then the 9th argument. if we call a function with 9 arguments, which means if you pop arguments from the stack, you pop the 7th argument, then the 8th, then the 9th. That's the reason for pushing them last argument first, because of how the first in, first out nature of stacks. So there are some exceptions to this. So you might say, well, what if I pass, you know, something which doesn't fit in a register? Like, what if I pass an object, like it's in C++, that contains 2 longs? How do I pass that to a function? And there are going to be exceptions for that, so there's different rules for cases like that. So cases like values that don't fit in the normal register, also for floating point values, which we could fit in the RDI, for example, but we won't. So there's different rules for some different types of arguments, but for the most part, we can get away with using these registers and then the stack. So the next question is, where do we put local variables? And as far as the calling convention is concerned, the calling convention isn't going to say, you must put local variables in this particular location. They're going to say, what are your options for temporary storage? Where could you put local variables and get away with it? Because, you know, if you have the option of using, say, some registers for local variables, and you don't, who can tell? Like, I can tell in a debugger, but as far as someone who's written another function that calls your function or is called by your function, I can't tell. Like, I don't know that you just happen to be storing the values that are already there or not. But our options for storing local variables are going to be that we have to store them either in registers or on the stack. And if we store them in registers, we're going to have some restrictions about what registers we're allowed to change. And by change, I mean change in a way where someone else can notice. So we're allowed to change any register temporarily as long as we change it back. So the only issue is if we put a local variable somewhere and trash another value that someone else may have been using. And we'll take a look at some examples of that in a bit. So the next question is, where do we put our return value? And in Linux, the decision is that it goes in RAX. Again, there's some special rules for cases where our return value doesn't fit in RAX for some reason, like we're returning, say, an object that's pretty big. There's some different rule for how that case is handled. So any questions about these basic answers? Okay. So, as I said, when we had this decide about storing local variables or other temporary values, we had this caveat that we have to make rules about what registers function calls can change. And the reason we need to do that is that if I'm writing some code, you know, I'm writing my function foo, and I have some assembly here, and I call bar, I need to know if I'm using, you know, say, R13 here, can I expect R13 to still have the same value down there? I need to know the answer to that question, and part of our calling convention is going to be answering that question. And the way Linux's calling convention decided to answer it is that they have this list of registers that function calls are allowed to change. That when you call a function and the function returns, all these registers are allowed to have different values. So something which is subtle here is note that this includes the argument registers. So once the function gets its argument, it's allowed to do whatever it wants with that register. Like, you can store something in RDI, it can recopy it to somewhere else, change RDI to some temporary value to do some computation. That's allowed. Also, note that just because you're not using argument 6, which uses the register R9, if you remember earlier, that doesn't mean the function can't use R9. R9 is on this list. The function's allowed to change R9 regardless of whether it's an argument or not. And sort of the motivation for having all the argument registers on this list is that there's kind of an assumption that if you're calling functions, well, you can't do anything useful with the argument registers anyways, because you have to set them specifically to call the function. So probably it's not a big cost to allow the function to do other things with them after they've gotten their arguments. So every other register must have the same value when the function returns. So R13 is not one of these registers. So if I set R13 to something and then call bar, R13 has to have the same value when bar returns. That doesn't mean that R13 wasn't used by bar for a local variable. That just means that somehow it got back its old value. And in fact, it will be very common for functions to use one of these other registers for local variables and then just restore the value before they return. And that is allowed. So let's go through some examples. So we're going to go through a whole bunch of examples of what this calling convention looks like from both the side of the caller and callee. And the first thing we need to talk about is what I mean by caller and callee. So the caller is the thing calling a function. So in this case, main is the caller of foo. The callee is the thing being called. In this case, foo is the callee. Foo is called by main. That terminology. Let's look at an example of a caller. Let's look at what this function call looks like in assembly. So we're calling a function foo, which takes a bunch of integer arguments, 8 of them in fact, and assigning its result to a local variable. So this is what this function call might look like, and we're assuming that we've used R11 for a local variable in the code which is calling this. So we, as a caller, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to save any registers that foo might change. And since if we're using R11 for something important, we need to save it. If we weren't, we wouldn't. You know, if we don't care what R11's value is, we don't need to do that. But since we do, we need to save it. And after we call the function, we're going to restore that value later on. And the typical way we'll do this is by pushing the value on the stack and then popping it later. This is not our only option, but it's just the most straightforward way with the instructions we have that always works. We don't need to think about, can I use this or not? So then we need to set all the registers for the arguments and push any arguments that go on the stack on the stack. So we set RDI, RSI, RDX, that list of registers I showed you earlier, to the value specified in the actual call. And we also have 2 additional arguments that don't fit in our list of registers. So those go on the stack, and we pushed in reverse order. So we push 8, the last argument, then the next to last argument, and that's then we've pushed all the arguments that don't fit in the registers. So that's our setup. So once we've placed all the arguments where they need to go, we're ready to actually call the function. So we actually jump to where the function is. And remember that this call instruction pushes just below those arguments that we pushed on the stack. It pushes the actual return address that we're going to return to. So our stack, we have our R11. And this is, remember, the direction it grows. We have our value 8, and we have our value 7, and we have the address of this add instruction. That's what the state of it things are immediately after the call, when we're in the middle of foo. Yes.
So then, in order for foo to access its local variables, do we have to pop that address and store it?
So the question is, in order for foo to access 7 and 8, those extra arguments, it has to pop that address and store it later. So that would be one thing it could do. Most likely, the code in foo is going to do something like, move RSP plus 8 to access that, or and RSP plus 16. We can just, rather than popping, we can just say, oh, I know this is this many bytes above the stack pointer, but popping it would also be an option. But yeah, if you read compiler generated code, I'd be very surprised to see them ever pop the return address rather than use RSP plus 8 and so on. So this call has placed the address of this add instruction that immediately follows the call on the stack. So then when foo eventually returns, it's going to have set RAX to its return at value, and it's also going to have potentially changed a whole bunch of registers, including RLL. So when it returns, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to remove those arguments we pushed on the stack from the stack. And the way I'm doing that here is by adding to the stack pointer. So our stack pointer, immediately when the function returns, it points here. And this is plus 8. This is plus 16. So we're adjusting the stack pointer by 16, that's 2 8-byte slots to point to that saved R11 we have earlier, removing those 2 push of 7 and 8 from the stack. So that's effectively popping them from the stack. I could have also done 2 pop instructions, but typically we'll do it by adding to RSP, at least the compiler will, because it's shorter. So after that, we want to restore our old R11. So we have that pop instruction I wrote earlier. So like if I'm doing this by hand, if I'm going to write a push, I'll probably write the pop at the same time so I don't forget. And so I remember to do it in the same order. And after that, RAX contains our return value. And I want to store it in this global variable. I'm assuming this global variable, we have a label for its address. So I'm just going to move into that address the value RAX. Yes?
When you're linking C code to assembly, will it already have pushed or moved all the parameters that's already out of RSA?
Question is, when C code calls assembly code, will it have done this? Yes. So this is how we call any function. And this is what we have to do for C functions and assembly functions and C++ functions. So the compiler generates this code all the time whenever it's calling some function, basically. You might see some exceptions in the cases where, the function's in the same file, the compiler could take some shortcuts. But if it's in a different file, it doesn't know what the code is, it doesn't know what registers it uses, it can't take any shortcuts, it's going to do all this work. Because the convention is the only rules it has to rely on to know what does the function do. So generally, when you're calling a function, or you're writing a compiler to call a function, the first thing you're going to do probably is save all the registers the function might change. So you're going to consult that list of registers the function is allowed to change. You're going to see, am I using any of these for anything important? And if so, you're going to save them. The easiest way to save them probably is pushing them on the stack, but you could copy them to a global variable and back, as long as you get the value you need later. Then you're going to place the parameters that you've chosen to have into the registers, that list of registers specified, and if you have more, or you have some special cases on the stack, then you're going to actually do the call. Then after the call, you're going to remove any parameters you place from the stack, because the call is going to return with the stack pointer at the same place when you called. That's part of the calling convention, is that the function doesn't make the stack pointer point somewhere else. It points exactly where you called it. So you need to remove that stuff you don't need from the stack. Then you're going to restore any registers the function might have changed, the ones you saved earlier. And then you actually have your return value in REX, and you should probably use it if the function returns something. So any questions about any of these steps? Okay, so this is the caller side of things. So let's talk about the callee side of things. And we're going to use this simple example here. So we have a function here, which takes three arguments, adds them together, and returns the sum. And here's one way to write this function. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, okay, I have a local variable result. I need to put that somewhere. The simplest thing for me to do is I'm going to just have a policy that all my local variables go on the stack. That always works. I'm never going to run out of space. That's the simplest thing to do. So the first thing I do is I allocate space for local variables. I have 8 bytes of space I need, so I allocate 8 bytes by subtracting from the stack pointer to make the stack pointer move down to give me 8 bytes of space on the stack. So then the stack pointer points to the place I just allocated to result, so I'm going to use memory at the stack pointer to store my result. So I'm going to first put 0 in it, then I'm going to add RDI, the first argument, then RSI, then RDX, first, second, and third argument. Then I need to return result. So my translation of this return result semicolon is that, well, my return value needs to be an REX before the function returns. So I'm going to move result into my return value. So I'm going to take that value from the stack, put it in REX. Then I'm going to return. When I return, I need to have the stack pointer be in the same place it was. So I'm going to add back. Wow, that was wonderful typo. Add back to RSP. And then return. So this makes sense. So this is one way of writing that. And so you can go through what actually happens here that, you know, say we call it, we have these values and registers, we search subtract from RSP. So we have our return address and our RSP now points just below it. Here. Then we store 0 there, then we add to it again, add to it again. We copy that value into RAX, then we add to the RSP, I put it right in the animation, just wrote the wrong instruction, and then return, actually using the return address and making the stack pointer point just above it when we go back to whatever called my func. So any questions about this? So next time we'll look at a couple other options we would have for doing the callee code, including what compilers will actually do when you look at them. And we'll finish up with some miscellaneous assembly topics.